So this is morning of 22nd or early afternoon of 22nd of December 2016, and we're studying from Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 4, Texts 1 through 13. This is Madhura Approaches Maitreya, and we're in Vrindavan at the VIHE. Udava uvacha ata. Everyone together. Ata te tara nugnata.
Udava pitva javarumin. Taya vilam sitayana durutaya pasri.
Thereafter, all of them, the descendants of Vrishni and Bhoja, being committed by the Brahmanas, partook of the remnants of prasada, and also drank liquor made of rice. By the drinking, they all became delirious, and in the breath of knowledge, they touched the cores of each other's hearts with harsh words.
Desham vairaya dosena, visham vikrita chetasam.
As by the friction of bamboos destruction takes place, so also at sunset, by the interaction of the faults of intoxication, all their minds became unbalanced and destruction took place.
Bhagavan Svatmamayaya Gatindam Avalokyasa Sarasvati Upasrishya.
The first Vaishnavya Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, after foreseeing the end of the lost family by his internal policy, went to the land of the river Saraswati, sipped water, and sat down underneath the tree. Aham
Chokta Bhagavata Prabhanati Ramenaha. Badani Chambrayahiti Sablaksagi Hirshina.
The Lord is the vanquisher of the distress of one who is surrendered unto him. Thus he who desires to destroy his family told him previously to go to Badarikashram.
Tadapi tadavi pretam jnanamamarindama. Pristato nyagamam dartu padavishleshanakshama.
Yet in spite of my knowing his desire to destroy the dynasty of Arindama Vidura, I followed him because it was impossible for me to bear separation from the lotus feet of the Master.
Adraksham ekam ashinam vichimvam daitam patim. Shiketam sarasvacham ritaketam aketanam.
Thus following, I saw my patron and master, Lord Sri Krishna, sitting alone and deeply thinking, taking shelter on the bank of the river Sarasvati, although he is the shelter of the goddess of fortune.
Shyamadvadatam virajam prasantarunalochanam.
The Lord's body is blackish, but is eternal, full of bliss and knowledge, and very, very beautiful. His eyes are always peaceful, and they are reddish like the rising morning sun. I could immediately recognize him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead by his four hands, different symbolic representations, and yellow silk garments.
Vama uradi vitya dakshinam risarorumam
apasritam adhisham chakrapipalam. The Lord was sitting, taking rest against a young banyan tree, with his right lotus foot on his left thigh, and although he had left all household comforts, he looked quite cheerful in that posture.
Tasmin Mahabhagavato Dvaipayana Suritsaka Lokananucharam Siddha Asasadayadrityaya.
At that time, after traveling in many parts of the world, Maitreya, a great devotee of the Lord and a friend and well-wisher of the great sage Krishna Dvaipayana Vyasa, reached that spot out of his own perfect accord.
Tasyana Raktasya Mune Mukunda Pramoda Bhavanata Kandasya Ashinvato Mamanuragahasa Samikshaya Vishramaya Nuvacha.
Maitreya Muni was greatly attached to him, the Lord, and he was listening
in a pleasing attitude,
with his shoulder lowered, with a smile and a particular glance upon me. Having allowed me to rest, the Lord spoke as follows.
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha Vedaham Antarmana Sittam Te Dhamiyata Durvapamanyai Satre Pura Vishasrajam Vasunam Matsida Kamena Vaso Twayeshta.
O Vasu, I know from within your mind what you desired in the days of yore, when the Vasus and other demigods responsible for expanding the universal affairs performed sacrifices. You particularly desire to achieve my association. This is very difficult to attain for others, but I award it unto you.
Sa esha sado charamo bhavanam asaditaste madanugraho yat yantavirlokam raha utsrijantam disya dadrishvan vasanuvritya.
O honest one, your present life is the last and the supermost, because in this term of life you have been awarded my ultimate favor. Now you can go to my transcendental abode, Vaikuntha, by leaving this universe of conditioned living entities. Your visit to me in this lonely place because of your pure and unflinching devotional service is a great boon for you.
Puramaya proktam majaya navye padne nisanaya mamadi sarge yanam paramam mahima babasam yatsurayo bhagavantam vadanti.
O Uddhava, in the lotus millennium in the days of yore, at the beginning of creation, I spoke unto Brahma, who is situated on the lotus that grows out of my navel, about my transcendental glories, which the great sages describe as Srimad Bhagavatam.
So the main theme that we're looking at today, I should mention with Uddhava as the pure bhakta and Maitreya Muni as the mixed bhakta. So I wanted to first look at the qualities of Uddhava and then the qualities of Maitreya Muni, and then we can do a compare and contrast. Okay. So in text 4, Krishna told Uddhava about the upcoming destruction of the Yadus, and he told him to go to and to associate with Nara Narayan to increase his taste for hearing, chanting, knowledge, and detachment. So, we talked about this the other day, the Lord saying, okay, I'm leaving, I'm taking everybody, and you stay. I have a job for you to do here. So you go to Bhadrakashram. But Uddhava follows the Lord. He's not able to bear the separation from the Lord. Can you think of someone else who followed the Lord after the Lord tells him?
Sita.
Okay. Anyone else where the Lord says, okay?
Lakshman.
She's good.
Anyone else?
She's not perfect. When his disciple went on in the mission and serving, and Prabhupada left, and he was in distress.
Okay, but I was talking about someone who follows the Lord.
Like Nityananda. Because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu asked him to go.
Oh, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu asked him not to come anymore to Jagannath Puri. He asked him to stay in Bengal. And he came anyway. He said, stay in Bengal and preach. Don't come here anymore. He came anyway.
But he did not follow us a lot. He disobeyed, no?
That's what we're talking about.
Disobeying?
Yes.
Yes. That's what we're talking about. Disobeying.
This is the point. I have the question. Really.
Yes, yes. This is from text 5.
Gadadhar Pandit also tried to follow.
Who? Gadadhar Pandit. That was actually the one I was thinking of.
How was? I don't get it.
Gadadhar Pandit.
Gadadhar Pandit.
when Lord Chaitanya was going on his tour, when he was going on his tour to Vrindavan, and Gadadhar Pandit had taken Kshetra Sannyas, and Lord Chaitanya said, don't come. And Gadadhar Pandit came anyway, and after a while, Lord Chaitanya said, all right, you've broken your vow, now go back. You made your point, now go back.
I have a question related to this.
I bet you would.
Yeah, because the Lord asked him to not to go with him, and still he was pleased, and he told, now you have pleased me, and you'll go back to the...
So why is the Lord pleased by disobedience? Is that your question?
Yes. Because it's out of love and attachment? And
it's real love. What happens is they're so much in love that it's not that they're intentionally disobedient. You know, when we're disobedient, at least for me, when I'm disobedient, I can't speak for any of you, you're probably all in Krishna prema, but when I'm disobedient, is because I am a rascal. Only. Even when I'm obedient, it's because I'm a rascal. When I'm obedient, it's because I think, oh, I am such a good devotee. You know, so even my obedience is rascaldom. What to speak of my disobedience? So generally, we talk about this in Manashiksha, the dharma and adharma, nature. When Raghunath Das Goswami says, give up dharma and adharma. So generally, we motivate ourselves by dharma. I'm very good. I am so good. I do what I'm told. I do, woohoo, you made it. I do what I'm supposed to do. When I'm supposed to do it. How I'm supposed to do it. Therefore, I am a good person. And we pat ourselves on the head. Good person, good person. And that's how we decide what we're going to do. You know, should I watch TV or should I cook dinner? Well, I'm a good wife, so I'll cook dinner. You understand? This is how we make our decisions in life. Should I chant my rounds or should I go to sleep? I'll chant my rounds because I'm a good disciple. Do you all follow what I'm saying? Everybody understand this?
Yes.
When people sell products, advertisers, companies sell products, they sell it by people's identity. Everything is done by identity. Everything is done by sambandha, by what is one identity. And identity is always in relation to something. I am a rich person, therefore I should buy this car. Or I want to be a rich person, therefore I should buy this car. Yes?
Obedience take part or is more than love in the...
Not necessarily. It depends, because there's two ways of looking at Vaidhi Bhakti. One way of looking at Vaidhi Bhakti is just simply that your mood toward the Lord is more reverential. And another way of looking at it is that it's the sadhana that happens before your specific love with Krishna is awakened. So there's really... Because you can have Vaidhi Bhava and Vaidhi Prema. You know, the Prema in Vaikuntha is a Vaidhi Prema. They're worshipping God because he's God. Not because he's wonderful and sweet, but because he's God. So it's a different... Just like Rupa Goswami says, if you have conjugal feelings for the Lord, but you stay in Vaidhi, then you become with Queen and Dwarka.
Oh.
So there's two ways of looking at Vaidhi. One way of looking at Vaidhi is the devotee who hasn't yet developed raga and is functioning by intellectual conviction and is doing their sadhana for that reason. And the other way to look at it is someone who's perfect, but their perfection is very much in awe and reverence according to rules and regulations. And they wouldn't think of violating the rules, not because they're identifying as a good person, but because they'd be so afraid of offending the Lord. They're just terrified of offending. There's no way they would want to offend the Lord. Subal and Sridhar are not worried about offending the Lord. They're worried about displeasing him, but they're not really worried about offending him exactly. It's just like, you know, if you have a very close friend, you can insult your close friends, yes?
Yes.
Yes? Yes. Don't we all insult our close friends?
Yes.
And we don't worry we're going to offend them.
No.
You can say to your close friends, "You're a flaming idiot."
That's human.
It's intimacy. It's intimacy. You know? And you can say to your close friends, "Would you get out of here now? I need to get some sleep." You understand? So you can speak like that. It's a sign of intimacy that you can deal like that with close friends. You know, or the gopis saying to Krishna, you know, "Radharani's not going to see you." I mean, could you imagine us saying, of course we do say that actually in another way, but, you know, "Krishna, I'm not going to see you today." I mean, "Hello? Can I come in?" "No, I'm not seeing you." I mean, that would be a little weird. We go, "Oh, Krishna, you're here." Of course, we do tell Krishna to go away, but that's in another, due to our illusion. So, you know, that they can deal with each other like that. Madhusudana ties Krishna up. You know, the residents of Vaikuntha are not going to tie up Narayan. It's not... They're not going to go to Lord Narayan and say, "You're a bad boy." You know, they're not going to deal with him like that, because they would offend him. They don't want to offend him. They'd go to hell by offending him. So they have a mood of avaidhi, but that's not based on a mundane identity. It's not a selfish identity. But for materially conditioned souls, we have a selfish identity that I am a something. And we have an identity that I am a good something. Now, if you have an adharmic identity, you think that you're a good, bad person.
You're good, bad.
You're very good at being a bad person. So, generally, when we disobey in the world, it's because we're having an adharmic identity. I'm a rebel. I mean, I was corresponding with one devotee and who says that he accepts me as an authority. And I said to him, he wrote and he said, "I like to hear philosophy from so-and-so person." And I said, "Do not hear from that person. Do not hear from that person. Do not hear from that person," like 10 times. You know? And then he wrote me back and said, "You know, I don't want to be strangled by any particular religion. I want to be able to hear from whoever I want to hear from." So that's a rebel identity. Do you follow what I'm saying? That's an "I am a rebel. I don't want anybody to tell me what to do. I don't want anyone to strangle me. I want to be able to do whatever I want to do." That's an adharmic identity. So generally, when we disobey the instructions of Krishna and Guru, it's because we're taking on an adharmic identity. And generally, when we follow the instructions of Krishna and Guru, it's because we're having a dharmic identity.
Isn't that inability to control might also lead to
disobedience? Well, yeah, like Krishna talks about the fall down sequence. But everything comes from identity. Because you say we're unable to control our mind. That's not exactly true. Our mind is following our sense of identity. Our mind is meditating on whatever we feel is favorable to our identity, or trying to avoid what's unfavorable to our identity. So it's not exactly the case that we're just victims. It's not really accurate. It feels like that. Arjuna said, "It feels like I'm a victim." So we feel like we're victims. It seems to us that we're victims. It seems to us that I want to do this thing and I'm being forced to do something else. It appears to us like that. That's not the actual truth.
So it's false identity.
The actual truth is everything is false identity.
Krishna asked them to go back and do their duties, but they stayed for the last lila.
See, that's on the platform of love. It's spontaneous love. So that's completely different. You know, we may say that's the original of which this is a reflection. But when the devotees either obey Krishna or disobey Krishna, both is motivated by love and by a spiritual identity. Not that I'm a good person or that I'm a rebel, but that I just want to make Krishna happy. And it's a very, very different thing. I mean, we get a little idea of that in this world sometimes. Sometimes we actually have a little glimpse of something that's something related to love, where I just want to make somebody happy, and I do something just to make somebody happy, not because I want to be a good person or a rebel. And it may look like the same activity someone does to be a good person or a rebel, but it's not coming from that place at all. That it just flows from a feeling. And I've given this example in some of my classes. I was in South Africa at a place called Bloemfontein, and there was a couple running a restaurant out of their preaching center. Unfortunately, they're not there anymore. I didn't see them this last trip at all, but I heard that they closed. They were doing it with very little support. It was very difficult. And the woman was in the kitchen all day long, literally. She just never left that kitchen. She was always happy. And after being there for 2 or 3 days, I had a spontaneous feeling that I wanted to serve her. Which is very, very different from, I'm here as the guest and I'm supposed to do some service. It was not something like that. It was just a feeling that I want to help her. I just had an emotional desire to be helpful. That was not intellectual based. It was not planning. It was not a thought. It was a desire. And sometimes we have such a desire to love that we do something apparently against the normal flow of things. But as I said, usually when we do either in this world, it's contaminated. It's not that following is love and disobeying is egotistical. It's all egotistical. But generally, we should follow. Because everything's egotistical, at least for me. I can't speak for any of you. But at least for me, because everything's egotistical, it's better that I follow. Because if I follow, then I'm going to learn to love. Also, a dharmic identity is much preferable to an adharmic identity. So even if I have a false identity, a false dharmic identity is preferable. I have some hope. A material identity in the modes of passion and goodness is much better than a material identity in the mode of ignorance. If I'm going to have a false material identity, at least let it be in passion rather than in ignorance, or in goodness rather than in passion or ignorance. Generally, rebellion in this world comes from the mode of ignorance. Generally.
But the sense of being a good person is very, very subtle. Like sometimes we don't understand that was the driver.
Definitely.
So how do we know, or how do we change?
The main way one can tell as for whether or not one's motivations are due to false identity is how we respond when it's threatened. So if somebody threatens our false sense of self, how do we react?
Can you give an example?
Sure, somebody tells you you're not a good devotee.
Okay.
You're not a good mother. You're not a good disciple. know, and that's not just somebody saying it, but something happens. Something happens and you see, well, I'm not really a very good disciple. I'm not really a very good husband. I'm not, you know. Your wife's not happy with you. Your son's not happy with you. And then you're all upset. And you're all devastated. And you get angry at them. How can you not be happy with me? I've done so much for you. Well, that's the main way you can tell. When everything's going nice, it's very hard to tell. But, you know, as soon as there's some threat to that identity, when you realize, you know, hey, I'm not really that good. And most of our interpersonal problems comes from this. You know, I'm trying to be a good daughter, I'm trying to be a good sister, I'm trying to be a good husband, I'm trying to be a good disciple. And it becomes obvious that at least somebody doesn't think that that's true. That somebody might be me. I do something or I say something and go, wow, I'm really not a good whatever. Or somebody else isn't happy with me. You know, if I spend 10 hours making a class, you know, preparing a class, and I teach it and I really give it my best, and someone comes up to me and says, you know, that was a terrible class. I just slept through the whole thing. I don't even know why you bother teaching. And if I feel, well, just devastated, and I think, well, why should I teach anymore? And what's the point? And do you understand? If I just feel completely discouraged and depressed or angry, how dare you say that? Don't you know what a good teacher I am? Then I'm working on that identity. And whether that comes from your wife, your husband, you know, the other devotees, or some guy in the street, or your own mind.
How is tolerance greater than this threat?
Excuse me?
How is tolerance greater than this threat? Because many times...
Tolerance. Tolerance means that you see this stuff and you just kind of laugh at it.
Even if it's false identity. Even if it is false identity.
Only if it's false identity. So, in other words, if you know, if you've worked really, 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 really hard to please your wife, I mean, I know of a conversation happened between one husband and wife where the husband decided that he wanted to get another job even though it would be an inconvenience for his family. And he said to his wife, you know, so far in our marriage, I've inconvenienced my work in order to take care of the family. I've put my career at a disadvantage in order to take care of the family. And now I would like to put the family at a disadvantage to further my career. You see, all this time I put my family first. And the woman looked at him and said, well, it sure doesn't show. So, you know, that it's like taking the person's identity and smashing it into little pieces. You know, Prabhupada talks about the man who wants to take sannyas, and he'll say, you know, I've served the family for 40 years, now I'm going to take sannyas. And he said, the wife will say, what service have you done? You haven't done any service. So naturally, when this happens, we become disturbed. Yes? And in fact, we have that here, right, in this chapter.
Which this?
In the very beginning. The very first verse, that the Yadus were intoxicated, and so they were touching each other's hearts with harsh words. And from that, they ended up killing each other. So what are the main harsh words that we use? It's when we say to somebody, you're a failure at your identity. Or it could be just that they interpret that, yes. Or it could be we think that about ourselves also. It happens, you know, also if we think about ourselves and we think, wow, I really failed. I'm a terrible daughter, you know, I'm a terrible disciple, I'm a terrible this, and we beat ourselves up with our own words. So what does tolerance have to do with that? You look at that and you just laugh at it. And you say, but I never was trying to be a good husband anyway. You may not say that to your wife. But internally you say, but that wasn't what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to please the Lord. You may appreciate, you may not appreciate. I wasn't doing it for you. I wasn't doing it to be a good husband. I was doing it as a service to Krishna. And the feelings will be there in the material mind, but you don't identify with them. You just say, well, that's interesting. There's frustration in my mind. There's anger in my body. I mean, the time when I did this every day, all day, was when I lost a child. And what I realized was that there were chemical changes in my body. My body was preparing to be a mother, but there was no child to mother. My youngest was 10. I mean, I wasn't going to put him on my lap. And, you know, I had all these motherly feelings induced by bodily chemicals and no object for these feelings. So I had all this frustrated emotion, basically. And I just basically observed it. I just thought I wasn't going to try to stop it. But I just observed it. And there it was, you know. I'd see babies and I just would start to cry. And I'd never been a particularly sentimental mother type person. It's not kind of my nature. Not particularly sentimental at all. But I just looked at that and I said, well, that's interesting. Somebody else would look at me and I'd be... But inside, I'm just thinking, that's interesting. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, look at that. Look at the, you know, there are these feelings going through my mind and my body that are not me. It's a machine.
But you're not repressing them. Yes.
I didn't repress them, no. I just let them be. Eventually, they worked themselves out and they went away. You know, but if you repress them, then they just get stronger. Not attachment nor aversion. You know, a lot of us try to deal with heavy feelings by aversion. That doesn't work. They just come back and bite you later. You know, it doesn't work. But you can be the observer. Oh, there's anger in my body. There's sadness in my body. Oh, why is that? Because I have a false identity. Okay. I had a false identity that I was the mother of this child. And now I'm not anymore. There's no more child left to mother. Therefore, I can't be the mother of that child. Therefore, that identity is gone. And it was interesting. The midwife said to me, she said, you're not exactly mourning the child. She said, you're mourning your relationship with the child, how you projected that child into your life. And there was one guest recently in New York when when I was giving a lecture, and she said, so when someone dies, we're not really grieving for them, we're grieving for how their death took away a piece of our identity. Yeah, and I went, yeah, that's a fact. So you just look at that. Oh, the reason I'm upset, there's upsetness in my body and mind is because this is a threat to my identity. This is how Krishna describes becoming transcendental to the modes of material nature. He does not say that when you become transcendental to the modes of material nature, the modes of material nature go away. It's not what he says. He says, one who does not hate illumination, attachment, and delusion when they appear, nor long for them when they disappear, knowing that the modes alone are active. And Prabhupada writes in that purport, this is 14:22-25 Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada writes in that purport, he says, as long as you have a material body and mind, it will be affected by the modes of nature. But you become neutral, and you act as the observer. And by the way, this particular concept is not only there in the bhakti tradition. It's in the karma yoga tradition, the gyan yoga tradition, the jnana yoga tradition. The Buddhists understand this. This is a common understanding in all genuine religious and spiritual traditions. Now, how you achieve this realization of the observer is different in each process. We've discussed this before. In karma yoga, you achieve it by giving up the fruits of your work. In gyan yoga, through philosophizing. In jhana, through mechanically changing the life airs. And in bhakti, through attachment for Krishna. In bhakti, we do it directly by getting our real positive identity. That's how we do it in bhakti. We're focused on our real positive identity. So anyway, Uddhava's disobedience of the Lord was a natural, spontaneous outpouring of love for the Lord. He didn't think of it as disobedience. It wasn't a deliberation of I'm going to disobey because I know better. I know better what Krishna wants than he does, and therefore I'm going to disobey. That's generally why we disobey. Or they don't really mean that. You know, I had somebody writing me between 5 and 25 messages every day on Facebook. And, you know, I tried to tell this person very politely over and over again, it's just too much. I can't read all this. I can't respond to all this. And he said, well, you can read it whenever you want. I said, Prabhu, I'm never going to read all of it. It's too much. And each one is, you know, and half an hour long to read. So he didn't respect my wishes because he thought that he knew better what I wanted than I know what I wanted. Do you understand? He said, well, don't you want to hear and chant? Not all with you. So, you know, he was convinced that he knew better what would make me happy and he knew better what I would want, which is appropriate if you have a one-month-old baby. You know, or somebody who's has a high fever, or somebody who's mentally ill, or something like that. But it's not appropriate dealing with a rational, sane adult. It's very disrespectful to try to force something on somebody else that they don't want. You understand? That's not love. It's something else. It's definitely not love. So that's not what's happening when the gopis stay and when Uddhava's following, when Gadadhar Pani's following. They're not forcing their will on Krishna. They're not saying, well, Krishna told me to go, but it doesn't really mean that. They just love. They just love. You know, and in their love, they just So that's something. As I say, we get a little bit of an idea of that in this world sometimes, where we actually have something that you can call love, that induces us to do something that the person has said they don't want us to do, and then they're happy with it. That they're actually happy with it. So, but that's. In this world, generally, that's not.
Mataji, sorry, but isn't it like, it is also like giving space for others to grow? Does it mean like, if you're, sometimes we need to be pushed, sometimes?
Okay, if you're the guru, the parent, the teacher, the boss, you may sometimes have to push people to do things that they don't want to do. You shouldn't force them. I mean, if it's a little tiny child, yes, you may have to just simply pick them up and put them in the car. There's only so much you're going to reason with a 2 or 3 year old child. You know, if you try to have your 2 or 3 year old child run your household, you'll be very unhappy. Okay, it's time to go to the temple. I know, when to go. Okay, we won't go. We have to go to the store and buy some milk. And you want to go? Okay, you want to go. I mean, you can't run your life like that. You have to take the 2-year-old and say, we're going to the store. Hey, do you want to go? Well, I hear you don't want to go, but I'm sorry. I cannot leave you alone in the house when you're 2 years old and we're going. You know, I have to do that with my teenage granddaughter. I have to say, I'm sorry. I'm not going to leave you alone someplace, you know, I'm not going to leave you alone. What did you ask for? Sometimes she'd say, you know, can I just not go to the temple? I'll just stay alone in the room. Oh, in Delhi. We had gotten there, you know, late at night, like 11 o'clock at night to the temple. She said, can I just stay here and not go with you in the morning? And I said, no, because you don't know where you are. I said, if I leave you in the room and I go to the temple and you get up and you want to find me, you have no idea where you are. You wouldn't have any way to find me, and I'm responsible for you. You're a minor. So I'm sorry, you have to go with me. You know, but I'm not going to say that if she's 18. You know, and even with her, I do my best to not force. You know, I'm only going to force if it's absolutely, I just feel it's for her safety. You know, in general, we shouldn't force anybody. That force is the opposite of love, you know. Sometimes, if you're dealing with a dependent, you know, if you have students and you have to say, hey, you have this homework assignment and this is your assignment and you have to do it. But see, you're not forcing. I mean, you can have consequences. But if someone's not your disciple and they're not your child and they're not your dependent, then you surely don't try to force God. You don't try to, you know. Certainly you don't do it the other way. You know, we do that. Children try to force their parents and so forth. It's not actually appropriate. I mean, children can control their parents and wives control their husbands and disciples control their gurus out of love, but that's a different thing. Oh, can I please? I mean, it's up to you, whatever you want. I had a conversation like that this morning with somebody where they're in a superior position in a project that I'm working on. They're in charge. I'm the assistant. And I just said, you know, look, it's your project. It's up to you. You decide. I'm presenting this and that, and you can do whatever you want. This is what I would like to do, but it's up to you. So that's the way you deal with someone who's superior to you. I would like to do this, you know, but it's up to you. And if you say no, you say no. It's your, you know. I mean, if you're a kid, you might pout. You know, but if you're some cute wife, I suppose you could also pout.
I took a place like that. I used to take a class where I said Hebrew things, Dhammic and Adhammic.
Actually, I didn't start the class that way, but yes, okay.
So, are you saying both involve, you know, the two modes of nature?
Yes, absolutely.
I was trying to see from the life of Srila Prabhupada, at the very beginning, you know, I see that most of the devotees, Srila Prabhupada taught them many things that they were not taught.
Many things that?
Many things they were not taught in the house, in the at home.
Yes.
So, in that sense, against of ideology to attract them to themselves, they were just a basis of, you know,
Was it to attract them to himself,
yeah,
or was it?
It's just a selfless, you know, idea, a selfless service that enhances them to understand their, you know, occupation.
Probably both. I think both. I don't think it was one or the other. Okay, can we go on? Is this pretty clear? As clear as it can be to a conditioned soul like me? You know, that Uddhava's disobedience was on a different platform. It wasn't due to some adharmic identity. It wasn't because he's a rebel. And that, you know, our being rebellious towards Krishna is probably not bhakti. Even our obeying Krishna may not be bhakti, what to speak of our rebellion towards Krishna. Honestly, I mean, to really be honest. If we're really, really honest.
So what to do?
Sanatana Goswami says, even though devotion rises to you, O Madhava, mine's just a tilamatri. Mine's just, I only have a sesame seed of devotion.
Yeah.
I feel some devotion to you, Krishna, sometimes, but it's only as big as a sesame seed. But you can make impossible things possible. You can take my sesame seed devotion and you can make it real devotion. We have real devotion. We are souls. We have real devotion. But it requires mercy. Okay. Of course, Uddhava didn't keep following the Lord. Eventually, he did go. But he followed the Lord.
He was not there when the Lord left the body.
Was Uddhava there when the Lord left the body? Not sure. Then he sees the beautiful Lord with four arms.
But our Jesus had four hands.
Well, if he had four hands, he had four arms.
Yeah.
But I thought it was interesting that it said four hands instead of four arms. Because they usually say four arms.
Four arms. Well, let's see exactly what the Sanskrit is there. Okay.
What is, which verse? 5, 6?
7. Well, actually, in the Sanskrit it says dorbi by the arms. Does anyone know the literal meaning of dorbi?
No. It doesn't say in word by word.
Word by word it says dorbi by the arms, and then in the translation it says four hands. And the word for word it says arms, but I'm not sure what the literal meaning of dorbi is. And also the Lord was detached like a renunciate, and he looked like he was taking shelter of a tree, which was interesting since the Lord is everyone else's shelter.
Yeah.
In text 9 it says that it was natural for a pure devotee to meet the Lord.
But it says that since he is the source of everything,
He wasn't actually taking shelter.
Because the tree is his.
The tree is also his.
He's the
one. So in text 9, it's mentioned that it was natural for a pure devotee to meet the Lord. In text 10, it mentioned that when Krishna greeted Maitreya, he was actually glancing at Uddhava. So though he was greeting both of them, and he apparently was greeting Maitreya, his real glance was at Uddhava. And that Uddhava could get total rest, which is in text 10. Okay, now this is a point that I said that I kept telling you in every other class that I would discuss in this class. So I'm finally getting to this. Okay. So Uddhava is one of the eternal associates of the Lord, and a plenary portion of Uddhava was one of the 8 Vasus in the days of yore. The 8 Vasus and the demigods in the upper planetary system, who are responsible for the management of the universal affairs, performed a sacrifice in the days of yore, desiring to fulfill their respective ultimate goals of life. At that time, an expansion of Uddhava, acting as one of the Vasus, desired to become an associate of the Lord. Okay, so that's from the purport of text 11. Now, what Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says, he says, a sadhana siddha vasu entered into the nitya siddha of Uddhava. Jiva Goswami says, great devotees, who are sadhakas or demigods, are empowered expansions of particular associates of the Lord. In other words, at the time of the Lord's appearance in this world, some of the Lord's eternal associates may empower certain great devotees to assume their roles in the Lord's pastimes within the material world. Such empowerment is like the empowerment of Prajumna, who was the demigod Cupid, empowered by the Vishnu-tattva Lord Prajumna of the Chaturvyuha. Jiva says that Uddhava from the spiritual world did not descend with Krishna, but rather empowered a Vasu who took his role in the Leela. Jiva says the same principle applies to Devaki, who is eternally in the spiritual world, but empowered Prishna to take part in the Leela. So you have several different ways of looking at this. One way of looking at this is that Uddhava expanded himself as one of the Vasus. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says a sadhana siddha merged into Uddhava.
A sadhana siddha. One soul who was a sadhana siddha.
A soul who was a sadhana siddha merged into Uddhava and experienced the Leelas through Uddhava as if he was part of Uddhava. Jiva says that Uddhava empowered a sadhana siddha devotee to take his role in the Leela.
So pick whatever explanation you like.
Similar
but different. They're similar but different. One is a sadhana jiva that Uddhava empowers. Okay, you take my role in the lila as me. Another is that Uddhava himself is expanding and taking the role of a vasu who becomes a sadhana siddha devotee in the lila. Okay, another is that a sadhana siddha devotee actually enters into Uddhava and acts as Uddhava. Yes?
What does deva in your mean?
It's a fancy schmancy way of saying a long time ago.
I got it all wrong, even
though. And I have no idea, I mean, it could be found out if that was Prabhupada's word or if that was Hayagriva. Hayagriva was one of the original editors of Prabhupada's books. He was an English professor, and he was into, you know, Shakespeare and Dickens and stuff. And so he would use those sort of expressions. And every once in a while you find them in Srila Prabhupada's books. So it's, you know, you could find out. I mean, it's possible to find out because the editing, you can look at the original editing there for Prabhupada's books. They have the manuscripts and you can see where the editing was done. So I don't know if that was Srila Prabhupada's language. Also, Srila Prabhupada was educated in old British English.
Yeah.
So Srila Prabhupada sometimes used outdated, antiquated, old British ways of writing and speaking, which especially to us from America may sound a little odd. They're British and they're old. So generally the editors went through and changed them, because the English in Prabhupada's books is American English, because Prabhupada's first disciples were Americans. Because Prabhupada went to America. So you Britishers listening to this recording, sorry about that. That's just the history. And so it's American English. And generally the editors, when they found Britishisms, and especially old Britishisms, edited them out. But some of them stayed. And some of them Hayagriva put in. Because that's the kind of person that he was. And Prabhupada was very happy to have an English professor. He was an English college professor. He was a college English professor. So Prabhupada was very happy to have a professor of English edit his books, but Hayagriva didn't do that kind of thing. All right, anyway, so this applies to what we read before about like Samba and Kartikeya, Prajumna and Kamadev, Devaki and Prishni, and Uddhava and this Vasu, because what's happening in this chapter is Krishna is telling Uddhava, you were a Vasu, you did sadhana, and now you perfected your sadhana and you're going to go back to Godhead. This is your last birth in the world. And one may say, why is he talking like this to a Nitya Siddha devotee like Uddhava? Mm-hmm. So those are the answers. It's interesting, particularly because we are told not to want to become an associate, not to want to become Mother Yasoda, you know, repeatedly. The Goswamis and Srila Prabhupada say, just like you shouldn't want to become Krishna, you shouldn't want to become Mother Yasoda. You should want to follow in the footsteps of Mother Yasoda. You don't become Lalita, you don't become Yasoda, you don't become Uddhava. But obviously there are jivas who do.
Well, they play the role, but they are not actually the eternal Nitya Siddha.
Or they merge with them. Yeah. So we have three options here. One is that there is a jiva who plays that role and is empowered to play that role. That's one option. So there's a sadhana siddha jiva who's playing the role of Devaki, and the actual Devaki is not there. Devaki's empowered that person to play that role. That's one explanation given by Jiva Goswami. Another explanation is Devaki's expanded herself. She's in the spiritual world, she's also in the material world, in an expansion. Another explanation, given that, and that's Prabhupada's explanation, that there's an expansion. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's explanation is that a sadhana siddha merges into the form of the nitya siddha and experiences the pastimes. You know, like you have somebody coming along with you and experiencing everything along with you.
That means that two souls...
They're like a passenger in your car, yeah.
Two souls in the body.
Yeah, they're a passenger.
But they are not exactly...
No, they're another soul, but they're a passenger. And they're experiencing the Leela as if they were you. That's one of the possible liberations, you know, one of the kinds of sayujya is not that you merge into the Brahman, but you merge into Krishna's body. So you can also do that with these associates. You can merge into their form. So Sanatana Goswami talks about with the residents of Vaikuntha. He said that some of them came with associates. Some of them were walking in and out of Vaikuntha with their associates. And some of them merged their associates into their body. Okay, this is way beyond, what do they call it? This is beyond my pay grade here, folks. So if you ask me any questions about it, I probably will just say, I don't know. I'm just giving you this information. I'm just passing on this information from our acharyas and leaving it at that. Okay, if you want to discuss this, you're going to have to discuss this with somebody other than me. Okay, text 12. The Lord said it's Uddhava's last life. He'll be able to attain the spiritual world. And in text 13, Krishna says, I'm going to tell you, Uddhava, knowledge that I told Brahma, which reminds us of Krishna telling Arjuna, I'm telling you knowledge that I told the sun god. Okay, let's now look at Maitreya. Why are you looking at me like that?
In which text is this information about Maitreya? Because I thought we stopped in 13.
You keep thinking that I'm going consecutively through the verses. As I informed you yesterday, I generally, if I'm going to teach a big chunk of Shastra at a time, I generally am not going consecutively through the verses. I reorganize things into themes. Some people may go consecutively through the verses. Every teacher teaches differently. So some teacher, if they were teaching 1 through 13, they would just teach 1 through 13. I don't do that. I take the verses and the purports and the works of the Acharya and I reorganize them into themes. Do you know why I do that?
Because then it gives a complete vision of the topic.
Of that whole section.
Yes.
Yes, it gives you an overview of the section. It makes it much, much easier for you to...
Learn.
Remember and learn, yes. Much, 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 much easier. If we just went verse by verse through the section, it would be much harder to get a whole picture of the section. And, you know, we have just a couple hours, not even with this first session. They haven't contacted me yet, I'm just waiting for them. So that's why I do it that way.
Okay. In verse 13, can we also remember how Lord Krishna taught the four verses of Bhagavatam?
Yes.
Like, you know, instead of going through the whole parampara, you also give direct transcendental knowledge to Brahma?
Yes. Yes. Okay, let's go now and look at Maitreya. See, what I could have done is look at Uddhava and Maitreya in these verses. I decided to first look at Uddhava in the verses and then look at Maitreya in the verses. I could have done that with each verse said, let's look at Uddhava, let's look at Maitreya, let's look at Uddhava, let's look at Maitreya, let's look at Uddhava, let's look at Maitreya. Okay, so in text 9, it states that Maitreya was a great sage and a learned scholar and philosopher, but he was not a pure devotee.
Yeah.
And his meeting with the Lord was due to some good fortune. Now remember, Uddhava met the Lord just because it was natural. But with Maitreya, it was due to some good fortune. And
of unknown service.
Yes. Maitreya is also called a close friend of Dvaipayana. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur for text 9 says this is because Maitreya was like a son to Padasada, who's the guru of Dvaipayana Vyasa. Parasara, rather, who's Vyasadeva's father,
yeah.
to his guru. So Maitreya's guru is Parasara.
Yeah.
And Parasara is Vyasadeva's father. So it's kind of like, you know, Ashvatthama and Duryodhan sort of relationship. Dronacharya has a son and Dronacharya has a disciple and they're both friends. So Parasara has a son, Dvaipayana Vyas, and he has a disciple, Maitreya, and they're both friends. Yes. And again, we mentioned this before in regard to Uddhava. But again, looking at text 10, although Maitreya is described by Uddhava with many pleasing words, Krishna actually spoke to Uddhava,
yeah.
since he had more prema than Maitreya. Mm-hmm. Thus, the words describing Maitreya are in the Sanskrit genitive case to show less respect to him. Mm-hmm. And in text 10, although Maitreya was a devotee, his devotee was mixed. So the Lord reciprocates on the basis of the purity of our devotion, not on philosophical knowledge or external activities. So Krishna is not reciprocating with us based on how many books we sell, or how many rounds we chant, or how many sticks of incense we wave, or how much money we've donated, or how many verses we've memorized, or any of those things by which we tend to judge our own bhakti.
So he looks at the intention?
He looks at the purity of the love.
The intention is that?
The intention to please him, yeah. I mean, frankly, we also tend to do this with people in our lives. Right?
Yes.
We have close friends and closer friends and closest friends based on how much they genuinely care about us more than how much they do for us. Now, we may have practical relationships with people who do a lot for us. I mean, where I'm staying, there's a chokidar who's more than a chokidar. He really, he's kind of like the doorman in an upscale New York apartment complex. You know, he knows everybody who stays there. He gives messages. He gives parcels. You understand? He's not just the guard. He's friends with people there. So he does a lot. Whenever I stay at that place, which I don't always stay there when I'm here, but whenever I stay there, he does a lot of practical things for me. You understand? But he's not an intimate friend. You know, that's his job. He does beyond his job. He doesn't just do his job. He definitely does beyond his job. But he's there basically because he's his job. And it's not a very engaging job. And so he, you know, he's bored and he does. And he's a friendly, helpful person. So he's very friendly and helpful. But it's not that he particularly loves me. You understand? Does that make sense to everybody?
He does it with all those who live
there. He does it with everybody who lives there. He sees it as part of his job, and he's a friendly person, and he's a helpful person in general. He's a very nice person. But, you know, I appreciate that he does a lot. I appreciate it a lot. But it's not that I actually have some kind of close relationship with him at all. You know, I would never reveal any of my of my nature to him. It's a very, very, very formal business relationship. So we're also, my point is, we're also like that. People can do a lot for us. He's doing things for me. He doesn't have to do them. He's not required. You understand? If I say, hey, can you give this flash drive to Vishaka when she comes? He could say, look, I'm just a chokidar here. I'm sorry, that's not my job. Make your own arrangement. He could say that, but he doesn't. He said, sure, and he takes care of it. So Krishna appreciates that we do things for him. He doesn't need anything, not like me who needs something. He appreciates it. He likes it. But he's looking at how much you really love him, not just how much you practically do for him.
Won't he express care by doing things?
Yes, definitely.
But
so if your wife cooks or a servant cooks, they both cook.
The wife will cook more.
Not a necessarily. Sometimes a servant cooks more. Sometimes a servant even cooks better. Depends on what kind of wife you have. I know one couple where the woman told me that after the second day she cooked, her husband forbade her ever to go in the kitchen again. He said, "Don't you ever set foot in the kitchen again. Don't you ever try to cook anything." She said, "Yes, sir." So you might have servants who cook much better than your wife cooks.
But we express love by doing things for
people. First of all, doing things for people is not the only way to express love. It's one of many ways to express love. It's not the only way. It's certainly one way, and it's a valuable and important way. But you can also do things without expressing love. Doing things for people does not necessarily mean that I love them. Okay, this is logic, yes? You're a student of logic and mathematics and such? Yes? Okay. If there's rain, then there's clouds. Doesn't mean if there's clouds, then there's rain. This is elementary baby logic. If I love you, I serve you. But I can serve you and not love you. If I serve you does not mean that I love you. I can serve you for all kinds of reasons.
So what are the other ways of love?
What are other ways of love? People express love with words.
With quality time.
With quality time.
With
people with gifts. You know, there's a whole mundane study of love languages. What are your love, you know, how do we express love and how do we want love? And that sometimes difficulties in relationship is people have different love languages. This is a modern psychological theory. Mm-hmm. You're looking at me like I'm saying something in Chinese. So, you know, one person, like my mother, was always telling me that she loved me. And she told me how her parents never said they love their children. She said, "My mother and father never, ever said, 'I love you.'" And it really bothered her, so she'd always say, "I love you, I love you, I love you." But she said it so much, I'm like, oh, man. So some people express love by their words, and they want to hear words of love. Other people do it by their gestures, by their looks. Other people, it's through touch and physicality. Other people, it's what they do. Other people, it's through gifts. My mother also bought me a lot of gifts, but I never much felt that my mother actually loved me. So it's interesting that I have a negative feeling towards both gifts and words of love because of my mother. Because that was how she showed love, but I never took it as love. So both of those things I tend to code as insincere. Yeah. Yeah, people try to show their love for me with gifts and words. It's very hard for me to accept those things as sincere just because of my conditioning from my mother. Because my mother would give me a lot of presents and she would tell me she loved me, but she never asked me anything about me. She was never interested in me. She was never interested in my friends. She was never interested in what I was doing. She never spent any time with me. I never felt that she got to know me at all or anything that was of interest to me. And so it actually made me averse to gifts and words as signs of love. It's taken me a long time to say, you know, hey, maybe that person actually loves you and that's how they show it and everyone's not your mother. So, no, people express love in different ways. My father expressed love by being with me. He gave me his time every day. You know, he did things for me, but he was just with me. He would just talk to me and tell me stories. He made my breakfast. And he tried to do things with me that I would like, whereas my mother tried to do things for me that she thought were good for me, which is not necessarily in the same category. So anyway, Krishna reciprocates with the actual love, and he doesn't just reciprocate with what you know or what you do.
He doesn't reciprocate with what you know?
Correct.
What does that mean?
So let's say you've memorized the whole Bhagavad Gita and the whole Srimad Bhagavatam.
Okay.
And you could sit on the Vyasasan and you could quote every single verse from the Shastra and you could explain every single philosophical concept of the whole Gaudiya Sampradaya and all the four Vedas.
Wow.
So let's say you had that much knowledge.
Wow.
But you didn't have any love. Krishna would be like, whatever. So it's not just what you know. It's not, you know, it's not at the time of death that the Vishnu Dutas come and say, all right, what are the stages from Shraddha to Prema? Can you list them in Sanskrit and English and explain what they mean? Okay. A plus Gopi, B plus Cowherd Boy, D Vaikuntha. It's not like that. You understand? There's not some kind of test of philosophical knowledge. Our purpose of having philosophical knowledge is mostly so we can fall in love with Krishna. And we have service to do. Yes, we have service. We have a service to do for Krishna, for Guru. So other people can fall in love with Krishna. Not so we can just convince people to change their religion or something. We're trying to fall in love with Krishna. We're trying to get other people to fall in love with Krishna. And Krishna's not so impressed with what you do. You can build a big temple and you can, you know, always worship the deity on time every day and always finish your rounds by 4 o'clock in the morning. And he's not so impressed with that. Now, again, if you love Krishna, you will want to do things for Krishna. If you love Krishna, you will want to learn about Krishna. But you can learn about Krishna and do things for Krishna without loving him. And we shouldn't think that what I know and what I do is a substitute for love. It should be an expression of love, and it should be a way to grow our love. I should be doing and learning for the purpose of falling in love. Prabhupada talks about the old way of arranged marriage. The old way of arranged marriage is your mother and father arranged your marriage when you were a child. And you didn't have any love because you weren't mature enough to have romantic feelings for anybody. So then the little boy and little girl had their first, you know, their first engagement, marriage kind of thing. And then they were still living at home and they would meet sometimes and the parents would say, okay, give him the sweet balls and do this. And you're doing that to grow your love. And then I was talking to actually my daughter about this. And she was saying, you know, in the families where people had arranged marriages, they fell in love after marriage. You know, that after they were married, they were working on things to fall in love with each other. So we're doing the activities of bhakti and we're studying the philosophy of bhakti in hopefully to fall in love with Krishna. Bhagavad Gita 12:9. The purpose of abhyas yoga is icha, is a desire. The purpose of sadhana bhakti is to awaken that desire. If we're doing sadhana bhakti and we're not awakening any attachment or any desire, then we have to question, am I doing sadhana bhakti? Or am I doing something else? What am I doing? We should be growing in that. We should be growing in, oh, Krishna is so nice. I want to be with him. Not, I want to go back to Godhead because I'm suffering so much here and it would be really cool to have desire trees. You know? I mean, that's mostly how I think, just about my own liberation. You know, oh, I can't stand him suffering here. Just let me go to the Chintamani Dham. But not like that. I want to be with Krishna because I just want to be with Krishna. We should be getting a desire. You know, oh, I'd like to see Krishna defeating Krishna driving Arjuna's chariot and having a battle with Karna, and I'd like to see Krishna cutting off Shishupal's head, if that's your thing. There's a big painting in our Houston temple of Krishna cutting off Shishupal's head, a huge painting. And I told the authorities there, please get this out of your temple room. And they said, yes, Giriraj Maharaj told us the same thing. I said, so why is it still here? I said, you don't invite the public in America to a temple without this humongous painting of this guy getting beheaded. My God. You know, so we should want to relish that. We should want to relish Krishna playing ball with the cowherd boys and taking his cows to the Yamuna and whatever leelas we're attracted to, and hopefully we're attracted to all of them. I mean, wouldn't you like to see Lord Varaha flying through the sky?
Whoa! A matsya, golden, huge fish.
So we should be having some attraction. Prabhupada said we should become captivated by this information. We should be reading and studying, not so we can fill out a Bhakti Bhai Baba exam and get our certificate, which is nice, Prabhupada wanted that, but so we can fall in love with Krishna, so we can become attracted. So we can start changing our identity and saying, you know, what I really want to be is just somebody who's in love with the Lord. That's what I really want to be. And I want to go back to Godhead so that I can do better service. You know, if he thinks I can do better service here, fine. But I want to be in a position where I can do better service. And I gradually we should get a specific desire for service. You know, I wish I could fan him. I wish I could, you know, massage his feet. I wish I could play ball with him. I wish I could take care of his cows for him. You know, I wish I could decorate the kunjas for him. I wish I could feed him milk or whatever it may be. You know, that, and I wish I could do something. Just like I had that desire in Bloomington. I wish I could help her in the kitchen. And it was spontaneous. I wish I could help her in the kitchen. We all have spontaneous desires in this world. Yes? We all have spontaneous desires of relationships in this world. So we want to have those desires with Krishna. That's why we study. That's why we worship the deity. That's why we chant Hare Krishna. That's why we do everything. And as those desires start to awaken, we should do those things to express those desires. You know, so in an arranged marriage where there's not already love, so the man may give his wife jewelry in order to develop love. But after he loves her, he gives her wife jewelry to express love. Does that make sense? So we should do sadhana bhakti to develop the love that's already there in our heart. And as it develops, we should be doing sadhana bhakti to express the love we have and develop it further. But Krishna is not impressed by those things. It's not mechanical. Krishna is not a machine where if you just know what to punch in, you know, you get your candy bar. That's not the kind of relationship we're having with him. And he's not very interested in that kind of relationship. So Maitreya had a mixed relationship. He had some affection for the Lord, but he also had some personal desire.
What was his personal desire?
What was his personal desire?
Knowledge.
Do you enjoy knowledge? Most of us enjoy knowledge.
Yes.
Okay.
I try to see in light of what you say, like Ajavetina's Siskanchu, was that a mechanical feeling by remembering his son?
No, because when he was young, he had had some affection for Narayana. Also remember, he called his son with affection. There was emotion. In fact, I would imagine that there was extreme emotion. I don't remember all the gazillions of times I've died, but I think it's safe to assume that there would be a pretty extreme emotion when you're dying. And especially if you just had a two-year-old. One devotee photographer told me, two-year-old children are at the peak of cuteness. So, you know, the two-year-old, they're still very dependent. And they're extremely, extremely charming. And you're dying. You're dying. You're leaving this little, dependent, completely enchanting child. So he must have said it with extreme emotion. And Krishna, who takes the least we give and offers the most, accepted that emotion for himself. Also, the Acharyas say he remembered the real Narayana. But he wasn't perfect then. It was still considered Namavas. It was a shadow or reflection of Nam. It wasn't full Nam. Okay. So Maitreya had affection for the Lord, and this was shown by lowering his shoulder or his head in text 10. So that was out of affection.
And a pleasing attitude.
He had a pleasing attitude. So he had affection for the Lord. It wasn't that he didn't have affection. He did have affection. He wasn't just a gyani. He had affection for the Lord. But he was also had some attachment to this idea that I'm a philosopher. And enjoying that. Now, in text 11, when the Lord assures Uddhava that he would fulfill his desire to go back to God and have the Lord's personal association, it appears that when the Lord informed him of his indication to Uddhava, that then Maitreya could understand pure bhakti. That Maitreya, by association with Uddhava and seeing and experiencing how the Lord dealt with Uddhava, Maitreya's feelings changed. And he said, basically, I want that. Again, this is the point of bhakti. Our reading, our studying, our association, our coming to the Dham is all so we can say, I want that.
Is it in Chaitanya Charitamrita that it says that the price for prema is eagerness?
Yes.
Intense yearning?
Yes. Yes. Now, it has to be so intense that you want it so much that you are willing to give up anything and everything to get it. And that you don't want anything else. It can't just be, yeah, it would be nice if I had it. That's a good start. It has to be as crazy as some of the attachments people have in this world. Right? You have people in this world who get so attached to a woman or so attached to a man or so attached to a position in a country or a government or so attached to, you know, a new phone. We met a devotee. It was in South Africa whose son was murdered for his phone. They were so attached to a phone, they were willing to kill another human being for a phone. Now, not that we should kill anybody for Krishna Prema, but the point is that we should have that kind of attachment.
Ready to die?
Ready to die. These guys were ready to go to jail for the rest of their life for a phone. Which means that, and we all have that capacity. It's not just that these, you know, criminal people had that capacity and we're just sort of blah persons. We, each one of us, has the capacity for that kind of attachment where we're ready to sacrifice everything. Yes? We all do. So we want to come to that point with the Lord. And as soon as we're at that point, guess what? Then we immediately have it. Eko bahunam yovadadati kama. Krishna gives us whatever we want. I don't know why they are not here yet. I will WhatsApp them as soon as the class is over. And I keep checking and nope, nothing from them. So yeah, that's, and many times we do that by another devotee. In fact, this is the main method. You see Krishna's dealings with another devotee and that inspires us. Is that for prasadam or is that kanksha or is that, no, that's for the deities, must be for the doctor. Okay, so just a few interesting facts here from verse 1, that intoxication can affect even very advanced persons.
Yes.
You can be an associate of the Lord and intoxication can mess you up. I don't know what the percentage is, but a lot of crimes are committed under the influence of intoxication. A lot. Large percentage, yes.
But isn't that also what Krishna wanted to happen?
Yes, but part of the reason he wanted it to happen was as a message and a warning. So that's part of, just like with Yudhisthira and gambling. So that's part of the reason, was to send a message to everybody else that even if you're a yadu, even if you're Krishna's personal associate, don't think you can mess with intoxication. Harsh words affecting the core of the heart. And in this regard, I want to look at Bhagavatam 11.23, 2-3. This is also Krishna speaking to Uddhava, interestingly enough. He says, O disciple of Brihaspati, there is virtually no saintly man in this world capable of resettling his own mind after it has been disturbed by the insulting words of uncivilized men. Sharp arrows which pierce one's chest and reach the heart do not cause as much sufferings as the arrows of harsh, insulting words that become lodged within the heart when spoken by uncivilized men. So, Krishna is saying a physical arrow going into your physical heart, which, again, I've not had that experience in this life. I hope I never do. I'm sure I've had that experience in one of my many billions of lifetimes. But that's less painful
than
harsh words.
Why harsh words of uncivilized men?
One would assume that civilized people don't speak that harshly. When you speak that harshly, it's a sign of being uncivilized. Other important point here is he says there's almost no saintly person in the world. Even if you're a saintly person, if people speak to you harshly, you will have great difficulty of resettling your mind. Do we all experience this?
Yes. Effects,
yes. Yeah, obviously not all the time. But there are some words that when spoken to us or written to us, our mind becomes unsettled for hours, sometimes days, sometimes weeks, sometimes months, sometimes years. And it's so difficult when a person speaks harshly to us, it may be hours that our mind is unsettled, that we just can't settle the mind. It's just going crazy. Unfortunately, at the present time in human society, people speak really harshly to each other. We're really mean.
Especially when it comes from people that are very dear or close circle.
It's more painful when it comes from intimates. But it's even painful when it comes from people who aren't intimates. In my experience, even people that I don't even strangers. There's certain, not anything, but certain things. My god sister Sitala today came up to me. She said, do you know that somebody posted something negative about you on Facebook? And it's interesting. She said, why do devotees do these kind of things? Why do devotees post and write and speak harsh words? And we really should not do this. Yes.
But if you remember the pastime of Rahu, it was said that the most difficult assault is a physical assault, because he exposed.
That was the reverse, yes. That the least was the mind, the greater was words, and the greatest was physical.
Yeah, so,
and you could also say, in terms of karma, that's true. If you insult a brahmana, you don't get as bad karma as if you kill him. You know, you can't go cutting off a brahmana's hands and saying, well, Krishna says, you know, that's insults are worse. So from the point of view of the offending party, a corporal offense is considered the worst offense. Even in law, it's like that. You know, there's what's called assault and battery. Assault is a threat, as far as I recall. And battery is you actually hit them. I think I recall this from when one unhinged person threatened to kill me in one temple. And he came up to me and said, I'm going to knock all your teeth out and knock your brains out and kill you. But he didn't actually hurt me. Krishna's mercy, because there was a bunch of devotees there with black belts and karate who saved me. And then when we went to the police station, they called it assault. You know, many times we use the word assault meaning physical, but he didn't actually touch me. So battery would be if he actually had hurt me. So in law, physically hitting someone is a much greater crime than calling them bad names. Although calling them bad names and threatening them is also a crime. But psychologically, it can be more painful. I would assume physically an arrow in your heart is a lot more painful than someone saying, you're an idiot. Okay? My assumption, maybe, not having had an arrow in my heart.
Maybe because he was a Kshatriya, so they can't tolerate physical pains as compared.
Perhaps. But I think of it more, again, psychologically. My own personal experience is that somebody demeaning you verbally is more psychologically painful than somebody hurting you physically.
Because also our identification with our subtle bodies.
Exactly. Because it's much more hitting our identity. So, you know, someone hurting you physically, especially if it's repeated and especially if it's an intimate, is certainly very painful. But somebody insulting you with harsh words, it's like they're taking your very identity and tearing it apart. And that's not the same as somebody punching you. It just isn't. Now, that doesn't mean you should go around punching people. And it doesn't mean it's okay to punch people because it's worse to insult them. That's not what it means. Okay, just a couple other things. Just in text 8, that the Lord's leaning against the banyan tree indicates that the universe is small and that the material energy stays behind him, because a banyan tree is associated with the material energy.